Gift, she choked. Gift. You forced him to do that. You killed him. You could have let us go. You didn't have to make one of us die. Generous ones! Generous! Her voice rose to a shriek. You evil little monsters! Murderers!
Hello!
Once again, for like the third to last time this season, I think, to the Remedial Magic Podcast. My name's Brady, and as always, I'm joined by my brother Baylor and our good friend Delbert. Welcome back to the studio.
Thank you.
Yes, hopefully.
See how long you can go today without coughing.
Oh, we're trying. I've got 4 cough drops left.
The Rona really let you have it.
Listen, it's got to have been Rona, but I did have a negative test, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, even if it wasn't Rona.
It was bad.
You've been ill for a while, so.
Yeah.
Nice to have you back. It's actually why we took last week off, if I recall.
I did apologize to the Discord, and if you're not in the Discord, you didn't see it because I was sick. I didn't want to post anywhere else.
They right. did see it because I posted everywhere else.
Ah.
So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, we're here talking about Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below. Very close to the end of this series, or not this series, but this book. This week, talking about chapters 32 and 33. 32 called The Generous Ones and 33 called The Most Terrible Gift. But before we get into that, there's a few things that we should discuss as sort of lead intro topics. The first one is this massive message we all got in the Alex Quick Discord about how apparently the Harry Potter fan fiction community is the most toxic thing that has ever existed.
True. I did read that at some point.
It's a pretty interesting little topic of conversation. Baylor, did you look at this at all?
I didn't. No, I'm trying to find it currently. Which thread was it in?
It was from Theo.
It was in like announcements or something. Something important.
Yeah, it's in announcements.
Oh, okay.
It just says, I'm sorry to have to trouble you with this whole business, but since our server is more integrated, as it were, with the rest of the fanfiction community, I figured it can't hurt. Recently, the mod team of another server in the Harry Potter fanfiction community has been attempting to discredit other servers, authors, and mod teams. What? Is this stuff really that serious?
I have no idea.
Look, man, from what I heard on the inside is that Inverarity is currently planning an ambush on the author of all the other famous fan fictions for Harry Potter. So, in fact, I know so much about it, I have no idea any other authors in Harry Potter fan fiction. So, obviously, I'm kidding. But, it is surprising to see this, for sure. I guess, but, I mean, it makes sense, though. I mean, J.K. Rowling kind of herself put a division in the Harry Potter fan fiction world, you know, just on a political scale.
Really, Baylor? You don't know the name of any other authors of Harry Potter fan fiction?
I was trying to make a point. Obviously, I know Leo.
Ah, okay.
The legend. The legend.
The I was just trying to make a 400 point. Books a week or something.
Yes.
I have to say, I don't really understand. I'm looking in the actual server right now where this stuff is stemming from. And apparently there was just one user on Discord who has been causing just like a lot of shit, I guess, making stuff up, also harassing female members of certain Discord servers, as well as creating toxic situations in Discord servers as well. And so I guess what I have to say about that is, thank God nothing like that's happening in the Alex Quick Discord, because there's a lot of other questionable conversations that could be had that I'm thrilled we don't have to address here on the podcast.
Yeah, I can only assume that the person who's doing all this is Ezra Miller. So thank God they're about to be put away for 26 years.
Wow.
Yes, Ezra Miller, the one and only.
He pled not guilty today to some sentencing that, or to some crimes that could be 26 years in prison, so.
Well, he's kind of a lunatic, so he should at least get some help one way or another, I would think. More importantly, and a little bit sadder, a little bit more upsetting news even, I think, is the death of Robbie Coltrane, the man who played Hagrid in the Harry Potter movie series. For me personally, kind of a tough blow, because I really think that of all the characters in the movies, his portrayal of Hagrid has to be in the top five for sure.
It's very, very good.
Well, I mean, he's kind of a key icon of the Harry Potter series, right? I mean, like, if you think of Harry Potter, at least for me, one of the first actors I think of is Robbie Coltrane. So, yeah, definitely was very sad to see him depart the earth.
It's too bad. He was 72 years old, and the thing about this happening now is that it wasn't too long ago that the Harry Potter reunion documentary came out, and Robbie Coltrane at the very end is talking about how Harry Potter is so special that it's going to live on forever. He won't, but Harry Potter will, and you can always visit him that way. And now that he's passed on, that kind of hits home even more than it typically would have.
Right.
Yeah, I follow, I believe it was the Harry Potter, Wizarding World of Harry Potter, either that or a different fan page for Harry Potter, and they posted all of the actors and actresses that have passed away.
There's a lot.
Yeah, and it brought back some feels for sure. Just, you know, thinking of all the good memories with those people.
I know the first Dumbledore, I know Vernon, Draco's mom.
Yep.
Forget her name.
Narcissa. The actress who played Narcissa.
Yeah.
There's been quite a few deaths at this point. Alan Rickman. Being
of
a
course.
Huge one, a significant one. And
I assume, and listen, if it happens the day the podcast comes out, I will take the blame. But Maggie Smith is looking pretty old these days.
Yeah, she is, but we're going to try not to divine the death of
right
of other people here. So Maggie Smith's going to live absolutely forever.
Well, you know, she has
said about the Queen.
She has the upcoming role of Knives Out 2, so, you know, she at least has to be there for that movie.
Yeah, the spoiler alert, at the end of the movie, she dies, but they just filmed the real life.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, my God.
This really started off as a meaningful conversation. Now we're just predicting deaths. But back on point, RIP to Robbie Coltrane. He did the world a great service by playing Hagrid the way he did. And honestly, if we're talking about a portrayal of a character translating from book to movie, Hagrid's got to be one of the best.
Definitely.
It the character fits so unbelievably well. The last little bit of Harry Potter news I have, if you guys have anything else, we can absolutely talk about it, but is Alan Rickman's diary has been released. And I think maybe we addressed this before a little bit, but now that there's more details, the man has dropped some real serious bombshells about filming the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
comes off as about as snobbish as Snape does in the series a little bit, sort of.
Yeah, doesn't he just say something like Daniel Radcliffe isn't a very good actor?
Something similar to that. He does point out that his favorite movie that he worked on was The Prisoner of Azkaban, which I know happens to be a lot of people's favorite movie in the series. And he said that's mostly because of the director, Alfonso Cuarón, did an extraordinary job with that movie. But it also talks about how he wanted to leave the franchise multiple times, right? He wanted to leave after Goblet of Fire, and then he wanted to leave again later on. And thank God he didn't. Thank God they got that worked out. Can you imagine that significant of a character with an actor change in the middle of the series.
Yeah, I mean, it's also different being that late, right? Like, we all know there's two Dumbledores, but when I think of Dumbledore, I'm certainly not thinking of the one from just the first movie. You know what I mean?
Right, well, and that also wasn't even a voluntary thing. That was because of a death, right?
Yeah.
And so, if Alan Rickman were to have left, it would have been so strange, especially given the significance of Snape's character going into the sixth and seventh book, right? There's a lot of focus on him. You can't just, like, write around it the same way Fantastic Beasts kind of did with Grindelwald, you know?
Right.
The other big thing, I think, is that Alan Rickman confirmed that he got some inside information from J.K. Rowling about what might have happened to Severus Snape. And it makes me wonder if this coincides with him wanting to leave, and so J.K. Rowling gives him a little bit of an inside scoop to kind of help push him to finish out the series, since Snape's arc is pretty significant, but that might mean he's the second person to know what the end of Harry Potter is going to be like, which is pretty monumental, I guess.
True. Who is the second person?
Who's the second person that knows the end of Harry Potter?
Yeah, because J.K. knows. Is it her editor? Her children?
Oh, it possibly could be Alan Rickman.
Family member? Alan Rickman?
It possibly could be him. It's hard to know. She evidently knew the end before she started writing the series or something like that. So, I don't know. Maybe she was sprinkling little seeds all over the place and there's just tons of people who are disappointed they already knew the ending when they got to it.
Fair.
I had actually heard, not really sure where, but I had heard that that is actually what J.K. Rowling told Alan Rickman in order to keep him on the set, was kind of some inside information, like you said, about Snape's arc. I'm not sure where I heard that at.
It says here that one small piece of information from Joe Rowling 7 years ago, Snape loved Lily, gave me a cliff edge to hang on to. Surely she told him more than that.
Yeah,
there's
no way,
right? But I don't know. It's interesting to get these thoughts coming from him after he's passed. This is part of, I have mixed feelings about this type of stuff because he did say some pretty negative things about the people he worked with and sort of the series overall. And these are the type of things where I sometimes wonder if it wouldn't be better to just let bygones be bygones, right? I don't know that it colors my opinion of him as an actor necessarily, but for some people, I'm sure this puts him in a worse light than what they originally thought of him as.
See, I kind of disagree, though, because, like, sure, these are his thoughts that he wrote down for himself to reflect on, but at the same time, we've heard from the children that worked on the movies. We've heard from Daniel and Emma and Rupert and, you know, the Weasley twins and everyone else. And they talk about how great he was on set working with them, even though he was such a seasoned, respected actor working with all these kids that had never really been in anything before. So, I mean, I think it's fine to feel like the way he felt, apparently, through the diary, but still have your actions being as wholesome and, you know, offering tutelage to a lot of these unproven actors throughout the movies.
I know for me personally, it definitely doesn't, I don't think of Alan Rickman any less of a person than I did before hearing, you know, I don't know specifically what he said, but we live in an age now where mental health is such a big part of life. And back when these movies began, you know, early 2000s, like, I don't think mental health was such a talked about thing, especially for other men. And so, like, for Alan Rickman to be able to use this diary to kind of maybe rant a little bit about his coworkers, about his friends, whatever it is, I think it's fine. I think everybody does that. You know, I mean, take a look at yourself. You go to work every day. You enjoy your coworkers, they're your friends, whatever. But when you get home to your wife or your girlfriend or your parents or whoever it is, you might say, man, that guy really annoyed me today, or, you know, something like that. So, like, I think it probably helped Alan Rickman, because I'm kind of speaking of my own experience when I'm able to rant about some stuff. It probably helped him be a better person on set and for the child actors who were learning and, you know, were growing every day in the light of all these people they are around.
The other thing, too, is this is a snapshot of how he felt at one particular time, kind of like what you're saying there, Baylor. I wonder how he felt before he died or if he was still alive now. I mean, Daniel Radcliffe, I think, has been very heavily critiqued because of Harry Potter, but still somehow in these like weird indie films he does, like Swiss Army Man and everything, gets praise from the critics. So, I mean, he clearly is a good actor now, and I'm sure Alan Rickman helped get him there. So I'm sure his opinions probably changed over the years.
Oh, I certainly imagine that they did as well. Actually, can you imagine being the child actors on Harry Potter and showing up to your first day on set and working with these massive, huge names in the British acting industry?
Not only that, this is kind of parallel to what we're talking about, but Draco, Tom Felton, he came out and said that one of the first days 9-year-old Emma Watson was on set, she did some like dance number that she had memorized. And him and his friends laughed about it, and he felt terrible and still remembers that moment to this day. So put yourself in Emma's shoes, 9 years old, working with, like, even your peers are older than you probably at that point, with Tom being around and whatnot. They're laughing at you, and you're working with all these big proven names. Like, I think the kids had a very tough time, especially in the beginning, but, I mean, they did a pretty damn good job.
I would agree, absolutely. I mean, the success of the movie speaks for itself. The last little bit from his diary that I wanted to point out is that I think he saved the last movie from having even more very key plot points that just got covered up by directing decisions and stuff. Because according to his diary, David Yates, the director of the last movie, wanted to have Voldemort kill Snape with the Avada Kedavra, and Snape's wife said, "You can't do that because then he won't be able to finish the scene. He won't be able to give Harry his memories." And Snape, not Snape, but Alan Rickman writes about that. He says, "David Y, stubborn as ever about Voldemort killing me with a spell. Impossible to comprehend, not least the resultant wrath of the readers."
Right.
So he did care about bringing the story to the conclusion that it's supposed to follow as well. I just think it's interesting to get a look, an insight into the behind the scenes perspective of somebody who's so involved in the world.
Agreed.
Yeah, I agree.
Also,
as well,
great turnaround for the man going from international fugitive that was injured by Bruce Willis into a potion teacher. Quite a life.
Yeah, I
well, regardless,
I wouldn't let these diaries, you know, shade your view of Alan Rickman at all. I just let it be.
No, I certainly wouldn't either. He's I mean, he's the giant in the industry that he is for a reason.
Yeah.
Is there any other Harry Potter news we should talk about today?
There is.
All right.
One small thing. Eddie Redmayne was interviewed, or maybe harassed by paparazzi, I don't know exactly which, but he was asked a question, and he responded to the question. The question was, will there be a Fantastic Beasts 4? And his response is, I don't know, you would have to ask JKR or the directors.
Okay, so no news at all.
Well,
so no other news.
I mean, pretty weird for him to just say, I don't know, as the lead of the movie. Or maybe not the lead of the movie anymore.
I don't know if it's really his place to say yes or no definitively, yeah. You know? I don't know. I just think they got to let it die. Just let it die. It's fine. Nobody cares that there's no news about it.
Fair.
Who's talking about the next Fantastic Beasts movie? No one. Just you.
Me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that one person that asked the question.
I'd like there to be another movie, personally.
I'd like there to be a coherent movie that makes sense and doesn't just belittle the people who are trying to watch it. That's what I'd like.
Starring Ezra Miller?
No. Frankly, I say get rid of the whole storyline, be done with it, and move on to something different.
Fair.
Well, I have some enlightening news.
Okay.
Nice.
I guess not news, but, you know, since we took a week off, it maybe has gotten forgotten or has been forgotten. But we received an email.
No way.
We did.
Yes, we did. And just for anybody who wants to also send us an email, because we're lonely, our email is remedialmagicpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can message us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at @rm_podcast. Sorry, that was hard. Anyways, the email's a little bit long, but I think I can read it really quick, if that's all right with you guys.
That's fine.
Go for it.
Fun fact, this is from Renee, and she is from Australia. So, across the pond. Anyways, she writes, "Hey guys, I'm a longtime listener, first time emailer. I just wanted to give you some encouragement since you haven't had many emails lately. I love the podcast. I listen pretty much every week, usually on my way to work. Of course, Alex Quick is awesome and listening to discussion about the series is fantastic, but also, you guys are just fun to listen to. I always smile when Delbert gets off topic with some random story and Brady tries to shut it down. I was wondering if you could share a rough breakdown of where in the world your podcast is downloaded. Are most of your listeners in the U.S.? I am in Australia. I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about when you bring up American sports stuff. How about discussing Aussie rules footy? Not really, though. I am enjoying learning about American culture. Thanks for also sharing other fan
Collingwood.
I tried out the Earthmancer. It was good, but I have to completely disagree that it's better written than AQ. I can see why Brady would like it, because to start off with, it seems to be more realistic than the original Harry Potter. The characters do make more rational decisions. Did you read the sequel, Brady? Anyway, no way it is better than AQ. And before I sign off, I have to share my thoughts about casting. I picture Abraham Thorne as Joe Manganiello with long hair and a beard. I was thinking about maybe Lucy Lawless for Miss King, thinking of the role she played on Parks and Rec, and maybe Regan Redford in a year or two for Julia. She can do the southern accent and the bubbly personality. Anyways, thanks for your work. Number one Aussie fan? Renee. So, exciting email.
I have a couple. Yeah, I have a couple responses to make. The first one is that thank you for reinforcing that if you beg enough over the course of a long enough period of time, somebody will acquiesce to your demands and email you.
Nice.
So that's really good.
Does it also work if I beg for $1 million?
We can try and see what happens.
Ooh.
Secondly, as far as the Arithmancer goes, I don't believe I said it was better than Alex Quick. I said it was better written, which I guess you addressed, so excuse me for being hasty. So instead, what I'll say is, to enjoy the Arithmancer, you really have to have a big brain.
Yikes. Are you just insulting our fan base?
No, it's a statement of fact.
Oh.
And thirdly, this brings us to a new segment on the show called Let's Talk About Australian Rules Football. And
yeah.
4 weeks ago, the Cats won their 16th consecutive match.
Listen, that's all fine. Collingwood Magpies is the only thing that matters in Australian football.
I don't know anything about any of it.
Okay.
The Geelong Cats won their 16th consecutive match.
First off, excellent sport. Would recommend watching some of it. It's fantastic. I don't know all the rules yet, but I started watching a little bit of it during COVID. Collingwood Magpies, definitely my team. Definitely the only team that matters, in fact. And it's partially, in fact, to one of their players. A 6'11" Texan who is now an Australian named Coxzilla.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good for him.
He's a gamer. Yep.
I have to say that I was into what you were saying until I read that they play these games on cricket grounds.
That's fine. They don't use the same rules.
You know?
Cricket sucks. Everyone knows it. Even people in India know it. They just, you know, pretend not to.
Okay. Maybe let's not piss off 1.3 billion people at one time.
Check our demographics. How many listeners do we have?
That's fine.
Regardless, thank you for the email. Baylor, do you have that demographic information that they're asking for?
I do. I was just going to bring that up. So currently 51% of our 40 listeners, so 21 of them, I suppose.
20.25 listeners
are from the United States. And hilariously, at number two, coming in at 14%, is our Australian fans. So actually a significant number of Australians listen to our podcast. And then it's kind of 8% to Germany, 5% to United Kingdom, 5% to Canada, and then kind of a hodgepodge of other European countries. But there is 2% from Japan, which is kind of fun. So, yeah.
About 1% from New Zealand.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. 1% from New Zealand just speaks to the rivalry between Australia and New Zealand.
True.
We 14% from Australia.
We had an email from New Zealand in season one.
Well, they're not showing up. That's what I have to say.
If you're still here, emailer, whose name I forgot, but I believe it was some, like, Pacific Islander name, if I remember correctly. Tell your family to watch so you can beat Australia. Just like the Collingwood Magpies beat anyone they play.
Except for the Geelong Cats.
Let's not talk about that, okay?
Go Cats.
Oh, I also listened because all the Aussie football teams have a team song. And there's one team that is called the Saints, and their song is literally just "The Saints Go Marching In."
Seems
just
fitting.
Totally stolen.
It's not really stolen. It's more of smart marketing.
Maybe.
Well, regardless, thank you for emailing us because it has been some time.
It has been.
Since we've had an email. And not only has it been some time since we've had an email, Renee, you Pacific Islander.
Nope, she's the Australian.
Renee.
Okay. That's not the that's not the New Zealander. You know what? I'm going through our season one emails. To
what
reminisce
is,
on
what is happening
times.
Currently, guys?
Oh, boy.
So what do you guys think of her castings? Joe Manganiello as
Janaya.
Abraham Thorne. Lucy Lawless.
Janaya.
For Miss King. Reagan.
Yeah, Janaya.
Janaya.
That's what the person's name was. And they said something weird, and I don't know what it means. They said, I can't pronounce it, but it means Happy New Year in Maori.
Yeah, Maori, that's the language, right? Yeah. I think that's pre-Samoan?
I have no idea.
Well.
Thanks for the email, though.
I believe the Maori are the ones that went to Hawaii.
Isn't Joe Manganiello the same person you casted for Abraham Thorne, Delbert?
I know that I considered him, and I know I've casted him for something, but I don't remember if it was Abraham Thorne or not. I think my big worry was he was too buff.
Oh.
What?
Thanks for that email. We appreciate it. Anyways, moving on.
What about all the stuff we just talked about?
Oh my gosh, we didn't talk
about anything.
Uh-huh.
We spent 15 minutes talking about nothing. We're 32 minutes into the podcast, and we haven't even started our discussion.
Listen, it was a great time. I don't know why you turned it off.
Anyways, good luck editing this, Baylor. Where we are today discussing Alexandra Quick and the Lands Below. Chapters 32... and 33. Chapter 32 is called The Generous Ones, and chapter 33 is called The Most Terrible Gift. The Most Terrible. But we're starting with The Generous Ones, and let me tell you something about The Generous Ones. They suck ass.
Yeah, they aren't very generous. or some would say they are generous, but with people's like, souls.
It's like toxic generosity, though, is the thing. You know what I mean? It's like, I gave you something, now you have to give me something.
Or I own you.
You know what I mean? I hate it, and I don't like it. Also, they're not house elves, I guess it's established in this chapter, because they have a house elf working for them, bound by some mysterious debt in some way. So I guess they're not house elves, but I do wonder what they look like, because they're the way they're described, they're very much described the same way that like our fourth grade social studies books describe Native Americans. They like live in clay houses, they wear loincloths and furs, they like trade in knickknacks and jingle jangles. You know what I mean? It's an interesting society.
I can agree with that, but I do think as far as how they look, I think it's close to elves.
Yeah, I agree.
You're probably right.
I think they're like...
I mean, they even wear...
They're almost like the ancestors of house elves, because they refer to Quimli, who is the house elf they have there with them, as like the lands above kin or whatever they say, so...
They even wear beaded clothes, you know? So, very, very heavy Native American vibes, in my opinion.
Which makes sense, right? Because the lands below kind of, that's where, like, the Native Americans got their magical powers from. At least written in this story.
Yeah, I would agree. There's definitely a connection there. And I have to tell you, the longer we sit here and talk about this book in concert with the fact that I just got incredibly fired up by our previous conversation that I don't even know if the audience has heard or not. It's really up to Baylor whether or not they listen to all that. But
they better.
Now that we're sitting here actually talking about this place, Abraham Thorne is a scumbag.
Big time.
Like a huge scumbag.
Big time.
There is no coming back from the level of scumminess that he displays in these chapters.
Why is that?
Well, if we want to jump ahead, we can, but essentially what's happening is he has sent his child, both of his children, essentially, to certain death to further his own cause.
Yeah, we can talk about this later. That's fine.
We'll get to it, but he sucks the big one, and that's unfortunate for everybody else. But regardless, the generous ones, this society of creatures, elf-like, we assume, creatures, appears to be built off of giving gifts and using gifts to like place what is essentially a life debt on people or right. Creatures that come to them.
It's like serfdom.
Like, what is the power that they hold over? For context, they're constantly trying to give Max and Alex gifts in some way. New clothes, little knickknacks and toys, food, stuff to drink, a place to stay, and Max obviously knows that this isn't a good thing to accept because he tells Alex not to accept any of their gifts. But what is the power that they're going to then hold over them? At what point does that power take control? Because Alex received the gift of the flute. She stayed in their hut during this chapter. She took the service of their house elf, Quimli. But it doesn't seem to, at the end, have any certain pull over her necessarily. So how are we thinking that this gift giving power even works?
Man, I'm trying to think of a logical thing. I guess in the case of Alex, I don't know if it's necessarily, I know that Quimli said like, you know, don't accept anything from these guys because they can, every time they offer you something and you take it, they gain power over you. I like, we don't see like any magical power over Alex until the very end, obviously. So I'm almost wondering if it's like the power of trust in a way, you know, like you'll begin to trust them because they're giving you so much stuff that in the end, you're not going to understand what you're actually giving them. And then you're going to obviously, you know, give them your life, even though you didn't say that you're going to give them your life. If that
makes
sense.
The power of friendship.
It's not explained.
No.
Like,
no.
What we do find out is that the Generous Ones have a deal with the Confederation, and Abraham has apparently tried to get them on his side before, but hasn't struck the right deal, and so they have always fallen back on their deal with the Confederation. But what I don't understand is, like, what direct harm will come to Alex if she eats the food that the Generous Ones are offering? You know, Max eats the food, and we'll get to his fate in a little while, but Max accepts many gifts from them, and then at the conclusion of this little arc, still has the willpower and the want to leave this place and go back to the lands above. So I don't understand necessarily what the danger is, and I'm sure there is one, but it's not explained unless I'm just missing it somehow.
I guess my thought is that similar to when we see Dobby perform magic, it's like a pretty powerful, potent magic. And that essentially the worry is that these things feel that you're indebted to them. And then if you go against their wishes at that point, they might just take it out on you, essentially.
That is one thing I was wondering. Is it just that, like, once they give you a gift, if you don't reciprocate, then they'll just kill you.
Right.
You know? I guess that could be a power, but that seems a little obscure to me because what's their reason for doing that then? What's the underlying motivation behind that, if that's the case?
Know.
They want you to stay there forever, or I don't know. It's an interesting group, for sure.
I had a theory that, or I have a theory, I guess. That, I mean, we see that the Generous Ones are very powerful because they didn't want Alex and Max to be able to apparate. So they weren't able to apparate. So, like, it seems that they have a control over either just these little huts that they were staying in or the people themselves, not sure. But my theory is that they need people, and this all makes sense, you know, when we get to it, obviously. You guys will get it, but for the listeners. But they need people to go to the lands beyond in order to remain in good graces with the demons and monsters in the lands beyond. So they basically, by taking the gifts, like you said, Delbert, you're indebted to them. And so if obviously you're not just this perfect little person, they just sacrifice you to whatever is in the lands beyond.
So you're basically saying that they're trying to indebt people so much that they have no way of getting out of that debt, and the only thing left to give is their life?
Yeah, essentially. And the reason they want the life is because of the demons and monsters whatever else is in the lands beyond.
Right.
I think that's a fair explanation. I guess the one question that still leaves unanswered is there like a physical barrier or a mental barrier or a magical barrier that gets formed to you leaving then? Like at some point if they've given you enough stuff?
I don't think it's if they've given you enough stuff. I think it's just a barrier if the head guy of the Generous Ones puts on you. So like at the very end, Alex is trying to escape and she's basically being pulled back, even though she's on her powerful broom, until that guy's concentration is interrupted. And so, like, I don't think it's a power of the gifts themselves, but the power of the people that keeps them there. I think it is the magic of the people.
It's a very strange, regardless. The other thing that I find interesting is it seems like they certainly don't want any gifts from you. Like, if you give them something, they have to give you something else to make sure that the debt stays in place. Which is, it's interesting. There's an episode of The Office where Dwight and Andy keep doing things for each other, trying to top the next one so that they always have somebody who owes them one. And it's kind of like that sort of dynamic here where they give Max food, he gives them a wand or several unfinished wands, and they can't just accept that and let it be even. Instead, they then have to start giving him other gifts as well. And then it actually starts like a kind of like a little battle of who can give the most gifts, with them giving Max all kinds of stuff that Alex remarks seems to be stuff that you would just find that like muggles would just like throw away. Essentially, it's like that quality of stuff. And Max is responding by gifting basically everything out of his pack, including his broom at one point.
Yeah. I mean, Alex even notes that, like, the two generous ones were giving each other stuff, like when they first were greeting each other. And it was almost like 12 gift exchanges and just one interaction between the generous ones themselves. So now that you say that, it almost is like, you know, their main goal is just to one up each other and everybody who comes to visit them. Like, you know, to have the last laugh or the last gift or whatever.
Now, that all happens. We don't exactly necessarily get any explanation for it other than Max saying to Alex, like, don't eat their food, don't drink their water, don't take their clothes, don't do anything. And then it's time for them to go to sleep, which I understand that they're tired, but sleeping in a place like this seems a little bit risky, in my opinion. But Alex then meets a new house elf named Quimley, who I guess I've talked about already. And Quimley is not one of the generous ones. And it seems like Quimley is possibly the victim of this weird magic where once the generous ones have given you enough, you can't leave. Because he doesn't like being in this place, but he also says that he cannot leave this place.
Yep.
So what do you think Quimley came here seeking that got him stuck in this place? Or is he just the unfortunate house elf who must serve the generous ones for all time or something?
I have my own theory, but I don't want to get into it until we reveal all that happens in this chapter, because it's very much tied into what happens.
Same, actually.
Well, okay. We'll wait on that as well. We're just pushing a lot of stuff towards the end of this
right
conversation. To be honest, the rest of this chapter is kind of more of the same. It's a lot of Alex being cautious to not take the generous one's gifts, and also a conversation between Alex and Quimley sort of about what the situation is like. And Quimley also tells her not to accept the generous one's gifts. And he says that they're not gifts at all. Every time you accept one, it gives them power over you. And that's followed up by a very ominous statement that says, unless Alex and Max give back better gifts, they're not going to be able to leave the lands below, which is scary, I would say, considering they don't exactly have a lot of stuff to give to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, we see, you know, Max is kind of scrambling to try to find, like, gifts. I mean, that's kind of what brings him to be giving away all of his stuff, like his broom and everything. It's like he's just out of gifts, and he's like trying to get to the point where it's been enough gifts in order to achieve the goal that they're, you know, that was set out for them upon getting there.
Why do you think? I thought something interesting. I'm all the way at the end of the chapter now, but Alex goes to sleep. She wakes up and decides to call out for Max because Quimley tells her that Max is just next door. They do get together with each other, and they get ready to go back and treat with the Generous Ones again. And the Generous Ones find out that they found each other, and they're not very pleased about it, evidently. They don't look very happy. In fact, one of the Generous Ones looks annoyed that Max and Alex found each other. And so my question isn't really necessarily about the story. It's more of, if the Generous Ones are going to be annoyed that Alex and Max were able to find each other, why would they put them in the house right next to each other? Are the Generous Ones dumb?
I don't think they're dumb necessarily. I'm trying to find it in my reading here. If I recall correctly, I don't think it's necessarily they're annoyed that they found each other. It's more so that Alex is annoying, like normal.
I like that theory.
I'm trying to, because she says something when they're like, oh, you found each other. And then she says something snarky, and then it's like, he looked annoyed or whatever, you know? I don't know.
This is part of this arc that, again, gets me fired up about Abraham Thorne being a little dingbat, because Alex says, or Max tells Alex that Abraham can't come down there unless they bring him back the means to do so. And Alex says, well, tell him tough luck. Why can't he just find an obol? And, you know, I kind of agree with that again, right? If Abraham Thorne is this big, powerful wizard guy that everybody's scared of and the Confederation is worried about, why couldn't he have just done this himself? I think we've talked about this many times. Why couldn't he have just gone to the lands below on his own? For me, it's not that he couldn't. It's more of self-preservation, which is not cool, bro.
He's a bad guy.
I mean, if he's been there and he's spoken with the Generous Ones, then yeah, I would say it's probably self-preservation reasons, obviously. My theory, I didn't think that there was any way Abraham Thorne knew what was going to happen, because there would be, if it was just Max there, there would be no way for this thing, whatever they charm in order to give him free passage between the lands below and the lands above. There's no way for it to be sent back to the lands above. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, but I guess I just don't, I don't know. It says he has sent generous gifts and promises before, but it hasn't matched the generosity of the Confederation. Right. And so because of that, it makes me think that he would obviously know that sending Max down here with a few pieces of wood that look like wands isn't going to be enough.
Yeah, that's fair.
Regardless, most of chapter 32 is sort of just meeting the Generous Ones, and then Alex and Max going to sleep. Max having accepted numerous gifts from the Generous Ones, Alex having accepted only the ones she basically didn't have an option other than to accept. Chapter 33 is where things get much, much more interesting. Because they go back to treat with the Generous Ones, and conflict arises.
Indeed it does. I mean, I do have a question for both of you, though, before we get into the depths of the conflict in the chapter. How would you pronounce the so-seemed leader of the Generous Ones? His name spelled C-E-J-A-I-A-Q-U-I.
That's a great question. I personally, and this is absolutely not correct, I would never pretend like it was correct, but I, in my head, pronounce this as Sayaqui.
Excellent.
But that means nothing as far as how it's actually pronounced.
I do know that Sam Gabriel, we had mentioned the audiobook a couple times in previous chapters, and using that as a guide. However, Sam informed us on the Discord that while most names are correct in the audiobook, this one was not. So I was completely lost as what to call this guy.
I personally have no idea, to be honest.
It's an interesting name for sure. Obviously, it's got Native American roots, and Native American language is tough because it doesn't translate directly into the like English orthography, right? The English alphabet doesn't necessarily apply. In fact, if you look at specifically Northern Arapaho language, a lot of those words have numbers in place of letters to represent sounds that we don't make in the English language.
Interesting.
And so a name like this one, Sayaqui, I couldn't tell you. I'd have to ask somebody who actually knows whatever Native American language this is pulled from to be able to answer that question. But it is an interesting name, and also that character itself is, I think he's pretty creepy, to be honest. He's like the friendly cult leader that you find out later in the movie is actually a horrible, terrible person.
Nice. He's Charles Manson.
Similar to that vibe for me.
Okay.
Now, chapter 33 is a very interesting chapter. We get confirmation here that what Max is truly looking for is a way for Abraham Thorne to pass from the lands above to the lands below at will, assumingly without a house elf to portage him across the barrier between the two realms. And I can only imagine what Abraham Thorne is trying to do with that power. It would be tough to say for sure what he's trying to do with that power. And it appears that the asking price is incredibly high for something like that.
Indeed. It does appear to be that way, yes. We also learned that, I think this might have been from chapter 32, but we learned in order for Alex and Max to leave the lands below, they have to be given a charm by the generous ones to leave. So that's why they're able to do this with whatever Max is wanting them to do it with.
It's a very interesting thing. We could talk about this chapter in a chronological order, but I don't think that that's going to do it justice, because there's really two, three maybe big main things that happen. And the first is that they sort of agree to give Abraham this thing. And at first the deal is not really clear, other than they need some sort of token that they can put this enchantment on to allow him to pass back and forth. And at first they try to let them use a coin to do this. Alex and Max try to let the generous ones use a coin to do this. And they say that a coin isn't good enough. It won't hold the enchantment well enough. And then Alex takes the locket that Abraham can communicate with her through and offers that instead. And that seems to work for some reason. Now, whether that's because it's a sentimental object or because it's already got magical enchantments on it, it's hard to explain necessarily. They don't really give that information. But what do you guys think about that? Is it because of the coin, or is it because of the sentimental value of the locket, or do you think something else is going on?
I think something else is going on, tied in with my Quimley theory that I was going to wait until we had discussed everything in the chapter to talk about.
Well, let's do that right now.
Okay. My theory is that this deal, which we're about to find out,
should
was...
we talk about this now?
Well, it's up to you.
Or should we announce the big sick twist and then talk about this.
I was about to announce it in that. So if we want to announce it first, it's probably the way to do it.
Max dies.
In the stead of Alex.
Yeah. Something goes on where the generous ones take Alex's offering of the locket to mean that she is the sacrifice. That's why Max brought her to the lands below, is to sacrifice her in return for this passageway back and forth between the lands above and the lands below. And Max, true to form, doesn't want Alex to die, and so sacrifices himself. And there's, of course, a lot of fallout, including Alex attacking the leader of the generous ones and then making a heroic, valiant escape away from the generous ones. But Max pays the most terrible price. He gives the most terrible gift, that's certainly for sure.
Right.
Yep. He's the gift to the lands beyond. He is basically sent through the portal into the lands beyond. The same portal that we saw in one of the earlier chapters where that demon in the Mors Mortis Society came out of. Not the exact same portal, but the portal to the same place.
Correct. Yep. He's dead.
He gone.
Adios, Max. We'd have a moment of silence for you, I guess, but we have taken too long in this episode, so we don't have time.
Hasta la vista, baby.
If Alex has had a good year, I would say, up to this point, behavior-wise and whatever else.
Yeah.
Because Max has been around to make her feel like she has family, I can only imagine what's going to happen now. He's, like, been the guiding force for so long, and now who does she have? Abraham Thorne? Uh-oh.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Yeah.
Regardless, though, Delbert, you believe that Quimley plays an important role in this situation.
I do, but the more I think about it, the more I want Baylor to go first.
What if I want you to go first?
Well, I don't want to accidentally spoil something if you're missing something that I thought was obvious at the time when I read this.
That's fair. So, basically, my only theory with Quimley, I don't think she was... Maybe she was stuck there because she accepted too much, but she even mentions herself that she accepted the most terrible gift, which is the title of this chapter, presumably because Max, or a human sacrifice to the lands beyond, is, I assume, the most terrible gift. So my theory is that when the Confederation was making this deal with the generous ones, because we just learned that in order to get this seal from the generous ones to pass at will through from the lands above to the lands below and back again, is essentially human sacrifice. So I am assuming that Quimley transported a human sacrifice or several human sacrifices into the lands below in order for this deal to be made with the Confederation. And I believe the reason Quimley's stuck there is because the Confederation has basically, she did the dirty work and she's banned from the Confederation. That's my theory.
It's an interesting theory.
Yeah.
It makes sense. I mean,
it's along the lines of what mine was at the time as well.
On a surface level, it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do have one thing to add. Quimley has been here seemingly for a while. Maybe long enough that Abraham Thorne was still in the government, climbing the ranks. My theory is that this is not the first locket of this type that Abraham Thorne has made, and rather it's a duplicate of one he made for the Confederation when they first made this deal, and he knew Alex would go with Max, so he just recreated his work to hold the enchantment.
Yeah, I guess, but why does that give the generous ones the idea that Alex is the sacrifice here?
Because they've made the same deal before?
I guess. Sure. I'm on board. Why not?
I mean, Quimley was above, I presume, above Earth, you know, in lands above before Abraham Thorne left the government, because she states she knows about the Elvish Welfare Act that Abraham Thorne passed or created or whatever he did. So, I mean, I don't think she would have heard about that from the lands below. That doesn't necessarily
my biggest problem.
Your theory's wrong, but
my biggest problem with this set of chapters is that there is no explanation for what Quimley's doing here. You know, which I guess is fine, because it's part of reading a book and making your own theories about it. But regardless, whether or not that's the case, whether it is Abraham who made the original deal on behalf of the Confederation, and the terms of the original deal is human sacrifice, or whether it's Quimley who brought human sacrifice down here. Again, the only person who comes out looking like they didn't do anything wrong is Alex.
True.
You know what I mean? If Abraham knew about human sacrifice down here and he sent Max anyways, that is a significant problem. Significant problem.
Yeah.
If he didn't know about human sacrifice and he sent Max down here anyways, knowing about how his gifts hadn't worked and the only thing he had Max bring was some wooden sticks and a few other magical knickknacks, again, not, it's a problem, right? He's not sending Max down here with any sort of preparation, it seems. You know what I mean?
I think he knew.
Yeah.
So if he knows, is he trying to get rid of Alex or Max, one of the two?
I kind of think Max.
Is he just accepting that this is the price I have to pay for whatever I've been trying to accomplish unsuccessfully?
I mean, I think we talked about it back in Roanoke. They're just pawns to him. And I'm pretty sure in that chapter, too, he's kind of treating Max like complete dog shit. So I don't really believe that he has a lot of love for Max anyways.
It's tough. Max is dead.
Yeah.
It's truly unfortunate.
I don't know. I just have a hard time believing. I mean, obviously, I've never been in the mindset of someone that would sacrifice their son, obviously. That's, you know, a given. I'm a normal human being. But, like, I just have a hard time, because of that, I have a hard time putting myself in the mindset where that becomes necessary at all. I don't know. I'm conflicted, because obviously I was pro Abraham Thorne. And if he knew that Max was going to die, or Alex was going to die, whoever he was had intended to send down there, makes him a pretty bad person. Yeah.
I kind of think the bottom line for me regarding this entire situation is that even if Abraham didn't know that Max was going to die or that Alex was going to die, the fact that Max did die makes Abraham Thorne as bad of a person as the Confederation wants to think he is.
Agree.
Even if he didn't know that, he still sent his children to death to further his own cause. Right? And we don't even know what his cause is. He's not telling anybody what his cause is. So as far as we're concerned, he sent his son to death to fix a problem that might not even need fixing, right? It's very problematic that Abraham takes this attitude towards Max and towards Alex to further his own cause when he's not even man enough to at least explain why that's the case.
I believe it's been referenced in this book that Abraham Thorne is doing what he's doing I don't think it's been said specifically, but for the greater good, right? The mean or the end justifies the means.
Well, sure,
I mean,
but
how
for the greater good does not mean good.
No, I'm getting there. I'm saying, like, I just thought of that, and honestly, Abraham Thorne just turned into Grindelwald for me. So
it's the same kind of problem, right? For the greater good does not mean for good.
Yeah, absolutely.
The only good thing we know that Abraham Thorne has done is introduce legislation to help out the house elves. That's the only good thing that we know for sure. And to be honest, his infatuation with the lands below makes me think that he only did that to try to get some access to the lands below. Not because he cares about house elves at all. I would have a hard time believing that he does care about house elves at the moment. Should we address the fact that Alex makes a harrowing escape from the generous ones?
It's pretty cool.
It is cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't.
She does make a harrowing escape, aided by Quimley. I assume aided by Quimley anyways.
Because Quimley
is shouting from the crowd, "Fly, Abraham Thorne's daughter, fly." So
and
we know that Quimley has... Yeah, Quimley has played a large, significant role in this. And one thing that's very important, actually, is that when Alex is making her great escape, she sees something glitter on the ground next to the fire nearby where Max just lost his life. And it's her father's locket that's still in the grasp of Sayaya Kui, the leader of the Generous Ones, who then promptly gets attacked by Charlie. So,
yep.
Are we to assume that Charlie is going to save the locket?
I mean, that's kind of what I assumed.
How pissed would you be if Charlie does not, in fact, save the locket after all that, and Max just dies for no reason?
I mean, it would fit the anti-Thorn logic. Like, it would make him seem even worse, obviously.
It would make me pro-Charlie death, for sure. Even though Charlie's trying to protect Alex, I guess. That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's pretty messed up.
Yeah. I mean, it is, on another note, it is pretty cool. Charlie kind of saves Alex's life here again, because the leader, I can't pronounce his name because I don't know how, is holding Alex back because she's trying to escape, and then Charlie obviously attacks him. The spell is broken, and she's able to fly away. So
Charlie's the reason they got to the Generous Ones, and the reason Alex is able to leave the Generous Ones. So,
yeah,
he's the coolest dude in town, as far as I'm concerned, with this book. But boy, I don't know. I mean, the death of Max, even though I've read this a couple times now, it's like a tough one to swallow.
I didn't see it coming at all the first time I read it.
Yeah, you nailed it from the freaking start of the book.
Yeah.
I had no idea that this was going to happen. I thought it would be, oh, they're going to go into the lands below. They're going to hear out what they have to say. And then they're going to leave. You know what I mean? Like, I knew that I've been predicting Max's death pretty much the whole book, I think, since episode 5, I think, is when I officially said it in my prediction. But, like, it came out of the blue for me, and I was very surprised, you know, like it was, once again, great writing by Amber Hardy, because went from that at the beginning, like, oh, this is a dream because they had Alex in this trance thing. And then, like, you get to the point where Alex has broken out of the trance, and the guy's like, oh, no, no, no. She's still being sacrificed. And then, like, you go, as the reader, you go through this thing where you, like, you're like, oh, this is actually going to happen. Like, they're not going to get away from this without dying. And then, obviously, it's not Alex, because there's 3 other books named after her. So, yeah, it was pretty shocking for me as well.
It's a pretty intense one.
Yeah.
I do think the death of Max is necessary from a literary perspective, because he's been her protector and her guide this entire book. And if he was around for another book, you wouldn't see her do anything on her own still. And so his death opens that up now. Now, for better or for worse, she's likely to be the person that Abraham Thorne involves in his plots to do whatever it is that he wants to do.
Well, that's kind of... That's kind of the unfortunate thing, is because Alex, like Max told her, once you do this, once you commit to it, you can't leave. And so now she does this mission. She commits to it, to the Thorn Circle. And her brother dies. And now she can't leave without basically being killed. So she's basically screwed herself.
It's a very precarious position for Abraham to put himself in my opinion, because Alex is the secret keeper of the Thorn Circle, and she could very well get so pissed off at her brother dying and her father setting it all up that she could just tell whoever she wants to.
She doesn't know who, though.
Yeah, well, doesn't matter. Know anything about it.
What's she going to tell? She hasn't met
the Thorn Circle still exists. That's all she has to say.
Yeah, but
to break the secret.
They still have Diana Grimm in on it, too, like checking on it all the time, so they still think it's active.
Well, they think Abraham Thorne is active, but they don't know who the members of the Thorn Circle are or anything. And as far as we know about the Fidelius Charm, once it's broken, all these memories and other things that you've forgotten about because of the Secret Keeper spell, they haven't just disappeared forever. They still exist. They're just obscured. Right? Alex could cause a lot of havoc even without the Thorn Circle stuff, because she could meet up with her dad and have it be a setup.
True.
You know? Mm-hmm. So, Abraham, in my opinion, misunderstimates Alex at every turn, but is doing that here as well, because she's got it in her to be vindictive in that way.
I don't know why, but at this point in the story, I feel like Abraham Thorne is like Dumbledore tier as far as dueling goes. So when you say like set him up in an ambush of some sorts, I still just, like, imagine him winning and then smiling at Alex and then just, like, apparating away.
he's made to seem that way, I agree, but we don't exactly have any evidence of that being true.
Right, that's the thing, is, like, I think that, but he could be worse than Peter Pettigrew, you know?
It's hard to say. I mean, there's still two books in, so many questions about that guy. So, I guess that's why you have to keep reading.
Yeah.
But we should probably, I believe we've covered everything important.
Yeah.
Max dies and Alex lives.
I do want to shout out one particular sentence from chapter 32, if you'll allow me.
Oh, of course.
There is a remark very early when you were talking about him telling Alex to refuse all their gifts and whatnot. And, they offer water and food or whatever, and he says, she's a girl. Girls are required to eat in private. They're also required to remain silent in public. And they're like, oh, we haven't heard this custom before. And he's like, oh, well, my family is very, very traditional. And then it says Alex's perspective is, and you are very, very dead.
Yeah.
Oops.
Oops.
My bad.
Oops, indeed. One thing I think is fun is that the generous ones call Alex troublesome.
True.
Everybody calls her troublesome, and
yeah,
seemingly they do it without the connection being made, which is fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Wandmaker did it on his own.
Yeah.
I don't think the Ozark twins had any influence before they did. I
wonder if that lends any credence to the troublesome prophecy from the Ozarkers.
Ooh.
Who knows? Be tough to say.
Troublesome vexes, troublesome woes.
Indeed. We'll reenact that someday with you guys. And
you'll have to take my part. I'm a little hoarse.
Another answer we won't get, or another question we won't get the answer to, probably.
Possibly. There's a chance. We should cast somebody, Delbert, since you wanted to cast somebody in this chapter.
I wanted to cast the entire group of the generous ones.
Cool.
I'm allowing up to two voice actors to do so.
Excellent. Well,
Brady, start us off.
Matthew Mercer is going to be my choice for casting as far as a voice actor goes to play the leader of the Generous Ones, and then the remainder of the Generous Ones. And frankly, he's so good that he could give them all a unique voice, and it would still be fine.
Are they all male, or is he doing female voices as well?
Oh, certainly there's got to be some females mixed in.
But you think Matt's up to the task?
Absolutely.
All right.
I imagine he's done well over 200 voices across Critical Role, so I have no doubt that he could play the, whatever, the 50-some-odd Generous Ones.
Right. I opted for two people, and I thought of Matt Mercer, obviously, because he's probably the man for the job realistically, but I like to be a little bit more spendy. So we're taking both Laura Bailey from Critical Role.
Sure.
And Seth MacFarlane.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
He does a lot of different voices.
Great. Now the forever the leader of the Generous Ones sounds like Stewie to me.
I don't know if that's the right match, but I'm sure he can figure it out. Baylor, how about you?
So I just listened to the podcast, or not the podcast, the audiobook. Because I was trying to figure out that guy's pronunciation until Darbert said that Sam Gabriel did it wrong. But I'm going to actually pick Sam Gabriel to be the voice actor for the Generous Ones.
Okay. So, there we go.
Yeah.
Congrats.
That's
Sam.
That's a good idea. It's kind of unfair because he's like the official voice, but you know what? It's a good idea.
I'm in.
So there you have it. To play the however many Generous Ones there are, we've just listed four voice actors.
Maybe we'll bring all four of them in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't cost that much.
True.
Sam Gabriel does a good job.
I bet for some reason Matt Mercer is probably not that expensive, even though he's probably one of the most talented out there.
I couldn't tell you.
Like, surely Seth MacFarlane is 10 times, 20 times the cost to get.
Sure.
As Matt Mercer.
Sam Gabriel is the only one that we have actual contact with, and she does a good enough job to make it work.
Fair.
We need to do an ARC MVP, Delbert. Who is your ARC MVP?
I'm going to leave you guys some of the more obvious picks and really throw a wild card in there. M.
Yeah. Go M.
We're seeing this side of stuff, but M's who really got him in here. And also, M's got to be having a horrific couple days. Gets summoned, puts two kids into a underwater panther cage, and then walks a few steps while sobbing and finds John Manuelito with his skull caved in and finds Darla almost dead on the floor as well.
It's either the worst day or the best day of her life.
Fair. I don't know, but rough times for M, and I don't want to forget about him.
Congratulations, M, on being named ARC MVP. Baylor, who's your ARC MVP?
Before we get there, do you think M knew that one of them would die or both of them would die?
Yes.
I think M thought they both would.
100%, die. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. I went with a more obvious pick because that was probably the most obscure pick Delbert's ever made, other than Josh Allen.
True.
I didn't
choose him for MVP, but I did choose myself for MVP one time.
True. Anyways.
True. Delbert, the king of obscure picks. I went ahead and went with Quimley because I think he's a bro. I told Alex not to accept their gifts because they gained power of them. Told Max that they were trying to sacrifice Alex and was able to get that stopped, even though Max obviously died. And then proceeded to probably be eternally punished by the Generous One because he helps Alex get away after she blasts the old crusty leader elf and fights all the others. So he's my kind of guy, you know.
Quimley is a great choice. I 100% agree with that pick. In the interest of time, my ARC MVP is the leader of the Generous Ones, so Yeyakui.
Nice.
For sticking to their guns regarding the deal. He believes that a fair deal was struck, and you know, when you believe a fair deal is struck, you just have to take a life sometimes, and that's the way it goes.
Right, for the greater good.
Exactly.
Don't actually do that in real life, please. And don't tell them we told you to do that. Thanks.
There are a few limited, very rare circumstances where taking another human being's life is justified. So, I won't say never do that, but I would say
Self-defense, maybe.
For the most part, don't do that. And if you do that, you cannot invoke the name of this podcast as your defense. That will not work. They'll listen to the other shit we've said on here, and it will not go well for you.
Yep.
True. Cool. Let's speed run renaming the arc. I'll go first, and I'll just rename this arc to A Very Sad Day.
That's good.
Delbert.
I'm going to go ahead and go with hell, in fact. Like, just hell.
Oh, I thought you were going to say comma, hell, comma, in fact.
No.
And that is so much better.
Is
that
it?
You have to pick that if you want to win.
Hell, in fact?
Uh-huh.
Hell, in fact.
Sure, I'm in. Sounds snobby to me, but I'm in.
I want to change mine to be sad, in fact.
Okay.
Well, I'm not going to change mine because mine is a stone cold stunner.
It's
wow.
It's him.
Holy moly.
From the top rope. Stone Cold Steve Austin.
I didn't know. I'm replacing M as my MVP with Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Holy
crap.
That's the best arc title of the whole book.
That was great.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord. All right. We have one last thing to do, and we've got 5 minutes to do it after that. Insanity. What an episode this has been. Baylor, would you please remind us what your prediction for this arc was?
So my prediction. First of all, they have met up with the Generous Ones. That was already known. Alex and Max will have a long discussion with them, finding out all of the Confederation secrets, except all of the secrets. So they won't find out really much. But they'll determine...
What?
They will determine what the Confederation offered the lands below in order to, seal up these entrances from the Native Americans. And they will figure out what Abraham Thorne must do in order to gain their favor. Now, the most terrible curse regarding this bone flute. Since they've accepted it, there's an unfortunate penance to pay. And that penance is Max's life.
You heard it here, folks. 10 out of 10.
13 out of 10. Let me explain why. I'm giving 3 points extra all the way back to like chapter 7 or something when Baylor predicted Max's death the first time we found out he was a brother.
I think it's fair.
Yeah.
I do think it's fair. So 10 out of 10, 13 out of 10, excellent work. Do you want to make a prediction about the next 2 chapters or do you want to just end the podcast with your highlight of calling Max's death a stone cold stunner?
Well, we probably should make a prediction.
Jesus Christ, Delbert's going to die. Killed Delbert.
It's a problem.
Okay. Do you have a chapter 34 is called Beneath Charmbridge, and chapter 35 is called Return to Roanoke. Do you have questions about those?
Yeah. Delbert, will there be a funeral for Max?
Yeah.
All right. Brady, does Alex get into trouble upon her return to Charmbridge?
Yes. I would say she does.
Alrighty.
You could say, in fact, that she gets back and some weird music's playing and JR says, "Oh, look out, he's slithering in," and she gets RKO'd by Randy Orton on the stone floor of Charmbridge.
Oh,
yes,
man.
And then it's followed up by the five knuckle shuffle from John Cena. Okay. All right. What's
Go
your prediction
ahead.
For those two, to the next
oh
two chapters?
Oh, my goodness. All right. So first off, I think Charlie does get the locket back because that is what Alex uses to get out of the lands below. She is obviously met with a party of both Charmbridge officials, Dean Grimm's there, the authorities are there, and then there's also some Confederation authorities there as well. Alex is heavily questioned why Max is not with her, but she's able to get away for the most part because the locket is as obscure as it seems. There, nobody knows what it is. Moving on, they return to Roanoke because that's where Max's funeral will be held. Miss King will be grieving for obviously a while. Same thing with Julia. But I do think while they're in Roanoke for this funeral, Abraham Thorne will make an appearance and there will be a showdown versus Alex and Abraham Thorne.
So can we be clear? You're predicting Alex and Abraham will fight each other or they'll fight on the same side as each other?
They won't fight at all. It'll be a vocal showdown.
Okay. That's cool. I like it. I think that's a good enough spot to end this incredibly boring episode off on. So, I've been Brady.
I'm in pain.
I've been Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Jesus.
Can you smell?